Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, we meet a collective of local flower growers who are coming together to compete in a market dominated by blooms from overseas. And a photographer explores the link between the American West and basketball. But first, it's the Friday newscap and some voices from the news this week.
Should the Supreme Court come down on the side that these folks should become Fed-only voters, we will advise voters appropriately, and the last day and moment to present proof of citizenship will be 7 p.m. on Election Day.
When we don't know whether or not they should be full ballot voters, and I don't believe that we should do this when we are 21 days away from the ballots going in the mail.
We believe it's a complete and total walk-off home run on behalf of voters who want to vote on Prop 140.
In Springfield, they're eating the dogs, the people that came in. They're eating the cats. They're eating the pets of the people that live there.
You make every minute count, and you do more with a minute than any other group I know. So I am asking you to lesson plan this thing out.
All right. My guest this morning, Lorna Romero Ferguson with Elevate Strategies and former Democratic State Representative Reginald Boulding. Good morning to you both. Thanks for coming.
Good morning. Good morning.
All right. So let's dive right into it. And the 100,000, that's a lot of voters whose registration is up in the air right now. It's just 6 weeks or so ahead of the election. Maricopa County Recorder Stephen Richer's office uncovered what they're calling like a glitch in the system that caused this issue. And it doesn't mean exactly that these voters won't be able to vote come November. Like at all, but we're kind of waiting to see what the state Supreme Court says here, whether or not they can vote in local and state elections or just on that kind of federal only ballot. I want to start with the kind of sheer timeline issue here, Lorna, and just talk about the stakes. Like 6 weeks and mail-in ballots are set to go out really soon. What are we looking at here?
Yeah, we're looking at mail-in ballots going out October 9th. You have overseas voters. I believe they're going out this weekend, maybe tomorrow.
Yep.
It just causes a lot of confusion. The timing is extremely unfortunate when you're looking at how competitive so many of these races are in Arizona. I mean, you look, Joe Biden won by 10,000 votes, right? Last election cycle. Everybody knows that the Trump-Harris matchup is going to be extremely close in Arizona. So having this question of what type of ballot these voters are going to get this close to the election and the confusion it's going to cause is not ideal for either party.
Yeah. Reginald, go ahead.
No, I agree. I mean, you know, right now, there's no reason to suspect that any of the, you know, 97,000, 100,000 voters are non-citizens. And, you know, the big takeaway here is that, you know, these voters, it will definitely play a particular role with the state legislature. So, you know, in the event that they're, you know, non-citizens, they'd be able to get a federal ballot. But if they, for some reason, that they're not able to get a full ballot, these state legislative races, which are expected to be very, very close this year, could have a significant impact on just who has power down at the legislature.
Right. So local races can be affected by what we saw like in the primary, like what, 45 votes or something, right?
Yeah.
So, Lorna, what races are you watching if, in fact, this does go that way and they can only vote on a federal ballot?
No, definitely. I mean, besides, you know, the Trump-Harris race, because obviously these are voters across the state. We're not just talking about Maricopa County. This is something that's impacting voters in every single county. But just looking at Maricopa County, as Reginald just mentioned, that's where most of the competitive legislative races are, right? And those are tight margins anyways, just because of the amount of the electorate in each of those legislative districts. And so when you're looking at, you know, J.D. Mesnard's race or some of the races in North Phoenix that will determine the makeup of the Arizona legislature and these voters, voters are only going to be able to get a federal-only ballot, not participate in those races, that changes the calculus for these, you know, these candidates in those races. And so as quickly as the courts can decide what is going to be the remedy for those folks, the better. But again, timing is not ideal for anyone.
Yeah, we're really up against it on timing. I want to talk about the political sort of strange bedfellows side of this story, right? Like, you've got Republicans now rallying around the Democratic Secretary of State, Adrian Fontes. He is calling for the state Supreme Court here to rule that they can vote on a full ballot, that, like, as Reginald said, there's no reason to believe that they are not, you know, legal voters here. And they've voted in many elections before. There are legal arguments here, obviously, but there's also the fact that the majority of these 100,000 voters in the breakdown are Republicans, right, Lorna?
Yes, they are. And you saw the AZGOP come out quickly and agree with Secretary Fontes that these voters should not be impacted for this cycle and should be able to vote the full ballot, which is interesting because the Republican Party has been very critical of Maricopa County and some of these other recorders when it comes to proof of citizenship for voters and whatnot and what ballots they should get. And so, yes, a large percentage of them are Republican voters. Republicans know that these are going to be close races and they need every active and eligible voter possible. And then also because of the time frame, you know, do you really want to risk disenfranchising this many voters as close to the election mm-hmm. for something that was not an error of their part? Right. This is a system error.
Yeah.
And for them to find out a few weeks before the election that they cannot vote fully would be devastating.
So, as we said, Reginald, mostly Republican voters here, but plenty of Democratic voters as well. What's the calculation on the Democratic side?
Well, no, I mean, you know, we talk about strange bedfellows. It absolutely comes down to the political calculus. When you look at the most competitive districts, that from a legislative standpoint, there are more Republican than Democratic voters that would be directly impacted and affected by this this unfortunate error that occurred. So I do believe what you're finding is that the GOP is saying, like, hey, if we want to still make sure that we win these races, that could be decided by 100, 200, 300 votes. We need to make sure that, you know, we ride this wave out, even if it means, you know, locking in arms with the Democratic Secretary of State, Adrian Fontes.
At least for now.
Least for now.
For a few days.
Know,
for a few days.
Absolutely. And, you know, I would say it is hypocrisy at its highest level. You know, we just got out of a court case in which you're talking about proof of citizenship, in which you literally had both the Speaker of the House and the Senate President, you know, arguing that proof of citizenship has to be, you know, established for these individuals here in Arizona to have the ability to vote a full ballot. And you know, now the political calculus has changed. A little bit of a change in tune.
Yeah. You both mentioned legislative races and the impact, potential impact there. What about when it comes to propositions? There are a lot on the ballot and a lot of really consequential ones.
Yeah, no, that's another fair point, because, again, these are voters statewide that are impacted. And so statewide questions like these ballot propositions, which a number of them are going to are extremely controversial. Right. You're looking at the abortion measure. Now we have open primaries that looks like it's going to be on the ballot. Like mm-hmm. these are ones that are probably going to be very close and contentious from just down the ballot party makeup. And so, yeah, 100,000 voters, it makes a big difference in some of those.
Yeah. Are there races you're looking at there in terms of the propositions, Reginald?
Yeah. I mean, I do. I know we're going to spend a little bit of time talking about the open primaries,
yes.
you know, proposition. But I mean, you know, as we mentioned, abortion, that proposition, you know, there's several up and down the ballot that can have direct impact and implications on policy here in Arizona. So, you know, for me, when I'm looking at the ballot, I don't necessarily support any of them outside of, you know, the abortion ballot initiative. I do think what you saw was the state legislature say, hey, we can't get these bills through the traditional process. The governor wouldn't sign them, so we're going to take it directly to the voters. And I do mm-hmm. think some of these bills may be a little outside of what Arizonans are asking for. But, you know, we're going to see.
Yeah. Let me ask you both lastly on this front about the sort of election denialism side of this, right, which this is kind of fueling again, you know, and fresh fuel for the fire. They found this problem because they were kind of cleaning the voter rolls and checking voter registration status of people. And they found someone who, in fact, was not a citizen. So does that make it a tough argument to make to disprove these elections conspiracy theorists?
you know, the election conspiracy theorists will take any random thing and run with it, right? And so that was a genuine concern of mine as soon as, you know, Stephen Richer and folks were making this public of what's going to be the reaction from these election deniers. And to see the AZGOP come out with their statement in support of, you know, wanting to remedy this after the fact and agreeing with Secretary Fontes, that kind of curbed some of it locally. But when you're going to continue to see that chatter, right? And I think the longer term issue is what some of these folks have already been clinching to is this idea that's has not been proven that illegals are voting in Arizona, right? Yeah. Non-citizens are voting and they're stealing the elections and Democrats are pushing this, right? And so it feeds into that narrative a little bit more. Mm-hmm. So I think the bigger concern is when the election doesn't turn out the way somebody wants, then pointing back to this as one of the issues.
Are you predicting that? Yeah.
I mean, look, let's say it. I mean, this is a PR nightmare for elections in Arizona. I mean, how does this happen at this point in time? You know, so much at stake. It's just not a good look for elections in Arizona. With that said, you know, I've already seen some national news outlets say, you know, this is the reason why Trump wasn't able to win Arizona back in 2020. And I would, you know, caution folks who actually aren't familiar with the Arizona, you know, election system to pause before they make those statements, because this would have not affected the 2020 mm-hmm. outcomes at all. Again, these individuals would have still been able to vote in the federal elections. So I do think that this was caught. I think, you know, Congressman Greg Stanton's statement was solid. I mean, he asked, you know, Secretary Mayorkas to do whatever he can to help expedite proof of citizenship for these individuals. And mm-hmm. I mean, you would think that we'd be able to do this for 100,000 folks, you know, to figure out whether or not they have, you know, citizenship and get this done.
Yeah. All right. We'll leave it there for now. We'll come back with more in just a moment. Lorna Romero Ferguson with Elevate Strategies, former Democratic State Representative Reginald Boulding. Thanks. Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. Now back to the Friday Newscap. My guest this week, Reginald Boulding, former Democratic State Representative, and Lorna Romero Ferguson with Elevate Strategies. I want to move on and talk about a decision in the case around the Make Elections Fair initiative that would create an open primary system, essentially, in the Arizona. A judge ruled yesterday it will be on the ballot. Of course, this could change pending appeals. But this latest challenge was about kind of the number of signatures, right? Like if they turned in enough signatures to get on the ballot, and the judge basically threw it out and said they didn't get, even if they didn't get enough signatures to get on the ballot, the challengers didn't prove their argument in time. Ballots are already being printed. Reginald, I want to start with you here. This initiative has gotten, it seems, more pushback in court and maybe elsewhere than any other measure this year. And there are a whole lot of them, as we discussed earlier. Tell us why. Why do you think this is getting so much pushback?
Well, when you look at the ballot this year, I would arguably say this is probably the most important decision that voters will make throughout the entire ballot here with the state and stakes of Arizona. You know, the outcome of this open primaries decision will have long-lasting impacts for the next, you know, two decades, I would predict. So what's happening right now is you had individuals who signed the petition multiple times. Those signatures were counted. You know, the judge, again, said, you know, the challenge was too late, but I think that sets a bad precedent. You know, if you have a ballot initiative that doesn't have, you know, the signatures, if they still are able to go to voters, that just sets a bad precedent when it's just so hard to overturn propositions. Mm. I don't believe that this is going to do what individuals hope it's intended to do, which is to make the legislature more moderate. You know, what you're going to actually see is incumbents are going to actually probably have much more of an opportunity to win elections now because they're going to have name ID. They'll have fundraising capacity as they'll be reaching out to a broader number of individuals initially and new challengers. If they don't have significant resources, it's just going to be so much more harder for them to communicate with voters. If you were targeting 10,000 voters, if you were a Republican or Democratic candidate, now you're going to be targeting 50 or 60,000 voters, and you may not have the resources to actually compete, which I think it will lead to more, you know, outside money, I think, determining whether or not who's going to be in these individual seats.
Mm. Lorna, what's your take here? Because proponents do say that, like, the argument is this will kind of get rid of the extremes in politics, which we've seen a lot of late. If you don't have to win a primary, the person in the middle who kind of represents the most Arizonans might win. Do you think that's what would happen?
You know, and I think in some areas of the state, potentially, right? I understand the larger concern about that either Democrat or Republican primaries have a tendency to yield the extremes on either side, right? Mm-hmm. And that independents aren't engaging as much as they can in a primary because obviously they have to take that extra step of requesting either a Democrat or Republican ballot, right? So creating the system where any voter can participate and all of the candidates are on one ballot, it makes sense in theory, right? Especially when right now the majority of the races in the state are determined in the primary, which has a low percentage turnout. So I understand the concerns of the proponents, right? But the reason why they're still in litigation right now is they're getting attacked by the Republican Party and the Democrat Party. They don't want the current system to go away. They want to maintain their primary system. And so, I mean, is it worth looking at? Sure. Do I think that the broader electorate thinks this is a top concern right now? I'm not sure. I'm not convinced of it. And right now, the proponents of the measure have been at a disadvantage because of all the lawsuits.
Right.
They haven't been able to, you know, have an active campaign as of date, right? And they're still waiting to see, you know, if this is going to be appealed and what the final decision is going to be with early ballots going out in 2 weeks. And
yeah.
So there has been a significant disadvantage from that standpoint. But I think it's worth the conversation of what do Arizona voters want when it comes to the primary election system here.
Do you think most voters have thought about that, Reginald?
I think voters have no clue that this, you know, they have no clue that what impact that this is going to have. I don't even think, you know, not even talking about voters, I don't even think fully electeds really truly understand like the implications that this is going to have. And, you know, I think that, you know, when you look at some places around the country, you know, you have some people who love it, some people who absolutely hate it. And I think here in Arizona, you know, we independent voters do currently have an opportunity to weigh in primaries. You know, independent voters choose whether or not they want to. And they actually have ultimate flexibility right now. And if they want to weigh in a Democratic primary, they can. If they want to weigh in a Republican primary, they can. That's full flexibility. But I do think that if this thing does stay on, which it appears that it will, I think it probably will pass, and I think that, you know, the fallout from that could be enormous.
That's really interesting. Lorna, last question here. Do you think it would pass, too? I mean, like, it sounds like you think there's a big education campaign that has to be done here first.
Yes. I mean, you're significantly changing how primary elections are run in the state. I agree. I don't think this is an issue that's top of mind for voters, so I think when they see it, they're probably going to be a little confused by it. It requires a lot of explaining from the proponent standpoint, right? And again, the time frame in which they're facing in order to launch a statewide campaign of significance is a little daunting. And so I'm not sure that voters are going to, one, understand it, and two, feel so compelled to support it, mm-hmm. especially when they're looking at so many propositions on the ballot year and such a long ballot, right? There's going to be voter fatigue, in all honesty. And I think every single campaign in the state is worried about that, especially where their question or issue or even their own race is going to be placed on the ballot. So that's something to take into consideration as well, just the length and the number of issues voters are going to have to, you know, vote on.
How long before they give up? All right. I want to spend some time this morning talking about immigration and the rhetoric around it this election cycle. We all heard former President Trump's comments at the presidential debate last week kind of amplifying these false claims that Haitian immigrants are eating people's pets in Springfield, Ohio. But I think it's continued to ramp up from there. Like, we're hearing a lot of, you know, claims about immigrants ruining the country, about committing crimes. The data doesn't really bear that out. I'm curious from like a political perspective, Lorna, like, do you think that that works? Like, is that kind of rhetoric going to get anywhere, especially in a state like Arizona where there are a lot of immigrants?
So immigration, border security is always a top three issue in Arizona, right? Depending on the election cycle, you know, it ebbs and flows between 1, 2, and 3. Mm-hmm. So it's top of mind for voters, especially Republican voters in the state or independents that lean Republican. Republicans know that this is the Achilles heel for the Harris campaign, right? This is one opportunity for them to really hone in on the failures of the Biden-Harris administration when it comes to border security. Where Republicans go too far is this anti-immigrant rhetoric that we've been hearing now, and these false claims of immigrants in Ohio doing this, that, and the other. So there's a big difference between talking about border security and making sure that illegal drugs and criminal activity are not coming across the border versus going after and attacking individuals that are just trying to come to this country to have a better life, right? Mm-hmm. From, you know, a refugee asylum standpoint. And so that's where if Republicans could just focus on the lack of security at the border, that's a winning issue for them. As soon as they start going into these far extreme conspiracy theories, that's when they start losing people, even some folks in their own party.
That's interesting. Reginald, I want to ask you about that exactly, that kind of attempt at a separation, I think from both sides, between immigration policy and border security, right? Do you think that the Harris-Walz campaign in particular is having any success trying to make that separation right now?
Well, this is probably the most frustrating thing that I would probably say if you're, looking at federal politics today, is that, I think the Harris-Walz campaign, they're consistently being asked about policy, and the Trump campaign is not. I mean, when you talk about fixing the immigration issues here, there are no, clear thought-out solutions that we're hearing from Donald Trump. There was a policy that was put into place that was supported by during the Biden administration, supported by Kamala Harris, that would have created the strongest border policy bill that we've seen in decades. And Donald Trump and fellow, Republicans chose not to support it. So since they can't win on this policy argument, they have decided to actually change the narrative to this us versus them. And them is, immigrants, they're rapists, they're murderers, they're eating dogs, they're eating cats. They're not like us. So this us versus them rhetoric is in the absence of actually clear-cut policy. Hmm. 4 years ago, 8 years ago, when Donald Trump was running, what we were hearing was Mexico was going to pay for the wall. That never happened, or are we just going to kick them out? That's not a clear, coherent policy. So in the absence of policy, you create this us versus them narrative to try to distract people. And I think that's the most frustrating thing. Immigration's an issue, but let's talk about policy to fix it.
That's interesting. Lorna, I want to ask you about this because it's a little more complicated, I think, in a place like Arizona, because the Latino vote is not as clear cut as people have thought it was for a very long time. And I think that's becoming very clear. Like, we're wrong, I think, if we assume that every Latino voter is going to vote for a pro-immigrant kind of stance, right? Talk about that here and your take on that and the way the Republican Party could be taking advantage of that.
Yeah, and you've seen this the past few election cycles, that the Republican Party has made some significant inroads when it comes to the Latino community here in Arizona and pulling away some of those voters. And key issue is border security, right? And when you look at some of the polling, some Latino voters believe that Republican candidates would be stronger when it comes to border security. But like we were talking about, bifurcating the issue, but they want more reasonable, sensible policies when it comes to immigration reform, right? Mm-hmm. And so that, coupled with Republicans being able to talk about the economy and kitchen table issues that a number of people in the Latino community care about, they've been able to get some of those voters, right? And so I think this is, we've seen this shift from probably the past, 15, 20 years where it was assumed that for Latino voters, the issue was immigration, right? And that was a winning issue for Democrats. And that's not the case anymore, right? There's a lot more nuance. There's a lot of diversity within the Latino community. And so now people are starting to realize they need to, really diversify their messaging and their outreach. And you're seeing Republicans do that. Trump has been doing well with Latino men as a result of some of his policies and whatnot. And so I would imagine that he's going to continue to target those folks. But again, the risk is with this, conspiracy theory, really high, this type of rhetoric, losing some of those voters that are actually gettable.
Yeah. Okay, last minute here, last word to you, Reginald. How do you think that Prop 314, the so-called Secure the Border Act, will play into this here in Arizona?
Well, again, there's been so much conversation around the border. I mean, polling that I've seen has shown that, it looks like it probably will pass. And I think that is unfortunate. I do think it was a mistake even being on a ballot. I think it really, went against what a single subject, law essentially says here in Arizona. And with that said, I do think that, there's going to be, lawsuits and conversation regarding this. But I do think, immigration is an issue. Coming up with, strong, border reform is important, and it's top of mind for everyone. In addition to, making sure that we have a strong economy, we're supporting folks, and the social infrastructure to make sure people have what they need. But, it's going to be tight.
Okay. All right. We'll leave it there. Reginald Boulding, former Democratic state representative, consultant of with Elevate Strategy, Lorna Romero Ferguson. Sorry, I'm stepping all
over. So many names. Sorry.
Thank you both for coming in. I appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, a new exhibit in the Valley explores the connection between basketball and the American West. But first, If you go to the store to buy a bouquet of flowers in Arizona, you're probably buying daisies or roses from out of the country. But a local group of flower growers is working to change that.
This is some beautiful xeranthemum, which is like a silvery white flower right now, but dries and looks almost exactly the same. There's some really nice apple mint, which has a great smell.
Goodness. Wow. That does smell like apple and mint. Wow. We are in the back of Baseline Flowers, the last standing flower shop in South Phoenix's once miles-long Japanese flower gardens. And there are about a half dozen local flower sellers mulling about and tables overflowing with color. Pink, purple, yellow, blue, and a lot of green.
These are called Queen Lime Red. We were trying to decide what color we think those are because they're like a weird mix of like three or four different colors and muddy in the pretty way. Mm-hmm. And some beautiful scabiosa.
That's Shanti Raid, the owner of Whipstone Farms near Prescott, where for more than 20 years, they've been growing 20 acres of vegetables and flowers of every shade and color. And she's here today as part of the Arizona Flower Collective, a coalition of growers from about a dozen farms around the state who sell their Arizona flowers wholesale to florists here. They take orders online, and every Wednesday, April through October, they meet here with piles of stems in tow so florists can pick them up.
Setting up this collective really allowed a lot of other growers to be involved. You don't feel like you're like this one person out there doing it yourself. And it made it so much easier on the buyers to go to one website, see everything that's available, get to make all of your orders like in one, you know, one selection and then come pick it up in one place. So it's good for the growers, like we're getting more business out of it. And it's really great for the buyers who want to support sustainable agriculture, local flowers.
They come from all over the state, even here in the valley, where they say, yes, you can grow lush flowers even in the summer heat.
Are people continually shocked that you can grow these in the desert here?
Absolutely. And I try to be really seasonal.
Ann Kerr grows amaranthus, lemon basil, and more right at the base of South Mountain on land her family has owned since she was a kid.
I do have hoop houses and things that I can grow in, but I try to grow mostly field stuff. And, you know, people worry about the water, but I irrigate. I irrigate about once a week in the summer, and that's it. That's all they get.
That's it?
Yep.
The collective is a way for local farm owners to boost their sales and be able to keep those family farms. For Prescott grower Terry Chouette, learning how to grow flowers in Arizona was the answer to a problem she encountered in her former career as a retail florist. Why couldn't she get local flowers to sell?
So we could get some. Shanti was already selling locally. And then we didn't have very many other growers in the area. In the late 80s and early 90s, the federal government started implementing trade agreements, subsidies to foreign countries to be able to bring in more flowers. They were able to provide them at a lower rate, of course, a lower cost, and American-grown farmers were not able to keep up with those prices. So most of those farms went out of business. So we're trying to bring that back.
Right. I mean, there are a lot of layers to that, right? Because, I mean, like, if you're just talking about sustainability and, like, emissions, like, I had no idea that, like, if I'm at the grocery store, the flowers that I'm buying have been, like, what, shipped in from where?
Ecuador, Colombia, Holland.
How do they stay fresh that long? Yeah. That's wild.
They do have preservatives. They are packaged in a certain way. A lot of things are boxed. So say hydrangeas, for example, will come when I would order them into the shop. They have kind of a cotton on the bottom that's soaked in water, and then it's wrapped in plastic and a rubber band for every single stem of hydrangea. And then you have to rehydrate. And sometimes that takes two or three times, a complete dunk of the entire head of the hydrangea. You have to cut the bottom, put them in ice cold water. There are many ways to rehydrate, and then they don't last nearly as long. So the difference is you get them here, they're cut the morning before.
So am I like assuming that flowers actually last a lot longer than I think they do?
Absolutely. Yes.
It's good to know. It's good to know. So I know you grow up in Prescott. You come down here for this. I wonder sort of how you got into this. You said you started in retail. Talk about kind of your growth in this and why you wanted to do this differently.
So yeah, I was a retail florist at 18 years old. I got my first job in a flower shop, and I was just sweeping floors and washing buckets, that sort of thing. Eventually got to learn how to design. When I moved to Arizona, I started working at Allen's Flowers in Prescott and got my Master Florist certification through the Arizona State Floral Association. And as I started managing one of those shops up in Prescott, started thinking, where can I get local flowers? We found Shanti. You know, we were able to get a few things here and there, but it wasn't a coordinated effort. We didn't have a lot of farms that we could get things from, and it was challenging to try to source everything and pick it up, you know, and order different ordering systems. So I started thinking, you know, where can I find local flowers? So I actually enrolled in the agriculture program at Yavapai College to immerse myself in the community, started freelance designing, quit my full-time job, and interned, was lucky enough to get a paid internship at Whipstone Farm through Yavapai College. So met Shanti and realized that there was a whole world there. She was growing much, much more than I had any idea. So we just started kicking around the idea of how can we get more people involved. And as we talked to people, there were plenty of people like me out there that really saw the demand and the need and desire to get more Arizona-grown flowers. So we just started talking. We came together. That was, I would say, about 8 years ago. And we just this year jumped in, said, okay, we just got to do this. So
so is this the only place that's doing this? I'm assuming, like, if it's been a challenge for a long time in the U.S. for farmers to sell and grow flowers here, that this is probably spreading elsewhere. People are trying to change that.
Absolutely. There are collectives and floral hubs all over the country now, and it just keeps growing. So we just started ours pretty late, actually, compared to a lot of other states are already organized, and most of them are regional. And we have such a large state, but we have such a diverse climate and zones that we can grow so many things at different times of year. We decided we need to just keep it all Arizona. So we've come together for people all over the place. It's an absolute team effort, and none of us could do this alone.
So I want to ask you about the goals and hopes in this in a moment. But first, tell us a little bit about the ecological side of this. Like, there is definitely a sustainability aspect of not tripping in flowers like we talked about. But there are, I'm sure, environmental impacts of growing things here for our local climate. Tell us about that.
Thank you for that question. I really appreciate that. So yeah, like you mentioned, the economic reasons are great. Also, the environmental impact, as you said, we're reducing the carbon footprint. We're creating green spaces, which is something we're really proud of, saving family farms. A few of our farmers are second, third, fourth generation farmers, and they've added flowers as a specialty crop to increase their sales and to be able to keep those farms. And they want to expand and scale up as well. So doing this allows us to do that. So we support local farms, feed pollinators. That's a big one, too. A lot of the things that we grow are intentional. Some of them are grown not even to be cut. They're just to help the farm and to provide nectar and pollen. So we have little patches all over the state, then I kind of consider it a pollinator path. And that's really exciting to me that we can keep growing that.
Yeah. For the bees, okay. So what are your goals in this? How far do you want to take this?
Oh gosh, I have big goals. A lot of us do for sure. What we'd like to see is a lot more farmers involved so we can provide a lot more product to go out to the florist, fulfill that need. So hubs around the state, delivery routes around the state would be ideal and amazing. But in addition to that, we're supporting each other. So not just the growing in the market, filling that market demand, but allowing people to keep those farms, as I mentioned, and have the real dream life of running a family flower farm. It's a real job. It's great. And if we can increase the market and increase the demand and get word out there, then they can scale up. They can make a full-time income. A lot of people have off-farm jobs as well. So we're hoping to let them be able to let go of those and just farm full-time and be able to grow more things, be home with their children, their aging parents. It's so much bigger.
Well, Terry, thank you so much for having me out. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thanks, Lauren. Thanks for coming out.
And if you want to see pictures of the Arizona Flower Collective, I wish you could smell the flowers as well, just head to our website. That's theshow.kjzz.org. Regina Revizova worked as a journalist under Vladimir Putin's regime, reporting from the North Caucasus for the BBC and other media outlets. In 2008, she had to flee Russia and seek asylum in the United States. Today, she lives in Phoenix and works as a professor at ASU's Walter Cronkite School of Journalism and Mass Communication. But Revizova still keeps in touch with old friends, and one in particular has been on her mind.
10 years ago, a friend was a luxury, as I just had immigrated to the United States a few years prior. 20 years ago, a friend was the base and the guide. 30 years ago, friend was all I, a small kid, lived for. Now, the friend is a tough matter. He lives in trenches fighting for his country, Ukraine. I learned how to talk to him without asking for specifics about his location or plans for the next hour, two, or a day. I learned not to ask things like, how many Russians have you killed since February 2022? Is it true they're always drunk? Is your parents' condo still standing in Kharkiv? Or was it in one of the neighborhoods Russia leveled? Where are your parents right now? My friend sent me his portrait. It was taken by a professional photographer from the UK who documents the war. In the photo, he is wearing a black t-shirt with an image of Ukrainian Trizup. His beard is trimmed, short haircut. I see some gray in the temple areas. He's looking into the distance. Like many Ukrainians, my friend abandoned the Russian language more than 2 years ago. He tells me he can't hear or speak it anymore, and I'm the only one left he uses Russian with. Teach me English, he wrote. I can use apps that translate to Ukrainian. I ask, would he abandon friend for not knowing an alternative language? No, he said. We would learn a new language together. I now learn so many languages with my friends. You teach me English. You've changed, I texted as I looked at the portrait he sent. I'm very old, he wrote back. No, I don't see you aging. Your eyes have changed, though. Changed how? They're stern. Stern? Yeah, like, you know, stern. It's because I'm not your age anymore. And by the way, we're both in our early 40s. I'm 70, maybe 80, he writes. Old people's eyes are different. Once, about a year ago, I had not heard from him for 2 weeks. And I thought that's it. I remember this empty void forming inside and around me, as if I just lost an important piece of my life. But he finally wrote back. I am sorry. They had to tie me down and take me to the clinic. Were you injured? No. I had a nervous breakdown. These are the moments where I really struggle to keep this exchange normal, as if two old friends are having a light chit-chat across this peaceful world. But he helps me and we go on. Things will get better when the war is over, I wrote back. Oh, I also learned that I got an award from Zelensky. I'll go to Kiev soon to get it. Send me a picture with Zelensky. I'll brag about you. Okay. Don't be surprised. I lost 20 kilograms. I'll be looking at Zelensky. I won't even notice you, I wrote back. He got the Order of Merit, 3rd degree, from the hands of the Ukrainian president for outstanding achievements in public service. As of late August, and that's when I'm recording this story, my friend is alive.
That was Phoenix-based journalist and professor Regina Rebozova. You can hear her essay again at kjzz.org. Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. A new exhibit at a Valley Museum explores the connection between basketball and the American West. American Backcourts is a collection of photos by Rob Hammer that shows improvised courts and hoops in places that would seem unlikely spots for a pickup game. Hammer road-tripped more than 300,000 miles across the country to take his photos. The exhibit at Western Spirit, Scottsdale's Museum of the West, showcases some of them. My co-host, Mark Brody, met Henry Terry at the museum to take a look. He's exhibitions coordinator there, and they started with what intrigued him about this series of photos and what about them seemed like a good fit for the museum.
Well, the gallery we're in right now is the Old West, New West Gallery, and so we're always trying to find artists that would not typically be considered Western artists, even though as you look at all of these photographs, they're very clearly of Western scenes. And so when Rob Hammer introduced himself to us a couple years ago, I just kind of have always had these basketball images in my mind as something that might turn into a nice show.
Was there something specific about the subject matter, about photographs of basketball hoops in maybe places you wouldn't expect them, that seemed like a good fit or seemed interesting to you?
Well, yes. I think what interested me about the having basketball hoops as Western art is the inherent ingenuity that comes out of these hoops. You have to be ingenious to live in the West. Historically, we think of pioneers in their wagons, the Sanagua people in their cliff dwellings. You have to have a certain level of ingenuity to live here in the West. It's a desert. It's high mountains. It's a rough place. You also have to be ingenious on how you have fun, how you spend your time. And so these kind of were just really perfect encapsulations of how do Westerners use their ingenuity to live in this place.
Well, so it's interesting you say that, because I think this photo that we're standing right in front of is a good example of that. You have a hoop on what looks like a utility pole on, I assume it's red clay. There's obviously no lines, like there's no free throw line, there's no three-point line, anything right. like that, with a single folding chair a little ways back. And like this is not paved. This does not look like a basketball court yet. There is a basketball hoop there, and somebody could very easily play.
Well, exactly. And to that point, these are pretty desolate places. I mean, you don't see any buildings in hardly any of them, or they're in someone's backyard on someone's ranch. And yet, what Rob has done is captured kind of the arena aspect of these. Who's watching this person play basketball? Whoever is sitting on this chair, but also the mountains behind it. Who's watching basketball on the photograph with the car? Well, it's the car, the mesa, the barns. You know, he's creating the basketball arena in this Western landscape.
So you've mentioned the word ingenuity a few times, and that kind of comes to mind on this photo as well, because this is, it almost looks like a part of Monument Valley, where you have a hoop that's a little crooked on a pole on what I can only imagine would be a field that would be very difficult to actually dribble a basketball on, because right. there are rocks all over the place.
Exactly. And, you know, with these hoops, are people playing 5-on-5 full rule basketball? Probably not. But standard principles will still always apply. You can always shoot a basketball, whether you're on gravel, clay, snow, asphalt. Maybe not snow. Snow would be tough. But again, yes, it's ingenious that they would place that hoop in this area right next to the mesa.
Is there something about basketball, you think, that makes this so interesting? Like, you know, you could put a soccer field. I mean, soccer is a universal sport, you know, throughout the world. You know, you could, in theory, put a baseball diamond or, you know, some other sport field there. Is there something about a basketball hoop that, like, seems to speak to people, that makes them want to put it up in the middle of nowhere on the side of a shed, you know, with only the mesa to see it?
Well, what I'd say, perhaps controversial, I don't think baseball is America's pastime anymore. I think basketball is. When kids go and play around the corner at their neighbor's house, they're not playing stickball in the street, they're shooting hoops in the driveway. And so I think basketball has just become such a cultural force in the United States that when people look to create recreation, basketball becomes one of the major drivers in that.
All right, let's keep moving down, because the next photo is super interesting, because it looks like somebody didn't even put up a hoop. They just put up a rim underneath a railroad crossing sign on a post. There's not even really a net. There's like the remnants of a net there. This is maybe the most primitive we've seen in this exhibit in terms of the equipment that somebody needed to make themselves a hoop.
Absolutely. And going back to that word, ingenuity, someone had this dream, had the vision, and executed it. Is this hoop standard? Of course not. It's not 10 feet tall to the rim. The backboard is not the standard backboard. Could you do a bank shot off this? I don't really know. But you know someone uses this hoop. Many people may use this hoop to play basketball. And that, again, goes to the ingenuity required to live in such a, quite frankly, dry, dusty place, but also have fun in it.
Right. I mean, the ground, as you point out, it's just dirt and maybe some scrub brush around the hoop. But, you know, this is, to somebody, this is their Madison Square Garden.
Exactly.
So what do you hope that people who see these photographs take away from it? What do you hope people who see this exhibit take home?
I think what I'd like people to take away from this exhibit is that people can be so ingenious with how they create their lives, how they influence their community, how they choose to live out here. And so I hope people look at this and come away with a sense that anyone can be a part of basketball, and therefore anyone can also be a part of American culture.
Henry Terry is Exhibitions Coordinator at Western Spirit, Scottsdale's Museum of the West. The exhibit, American Backcourts, will be on display through April of next year.
Basketball is my favorite sport. I like the way to dribble up and down the court. Just like I'm the king on the microphone. So it's Dr. J and Moses Malone. I like slam dunks and taking it to the hoop. My favorite play is the alley-oop. I like the pick and roll. I like the give and go. Cause it's basketball.
I'm going to talk very little so you can listen to this song. All right, that'll do it for the Friday edition of the show. We will be back with you again on Monday morning with much more, of course. If you heard a song, by the way, that you liked on today's show, you can't get out of your head. You can look it up on Spotify. Just search for KJZZ's The Show, and you'll get those monthly playlists. For Mark Brody, I'm Lauren Gilger. Thanks for joining us.
Against Earl Pearl and Will Bingo and Jerry West play basketball at its very best.
That's it for this episode of the show's podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, you can visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Lauren Gilger for Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.